We're talking about the Quantum Thief trilogy. Three books: The Quantum Thief, The Fractal Prince, and The Causal Angel. They appeared in 2010 through to 2014. They were all written by Hadu Rajaniemi, who's a Finnish author who's resident in Scotland and Edinburgh. Before The Quantum Prince appeared, he'd only been known for short stories, some of which were quite stunning. And given that he has a degree in mathematical physics, theoretical physics, and did his PhD on string theory, we presume he knows somewhat of some of the events he writes. The interesting thing about this trilogy is that each book has quite a different feel to it. The Quantum Thief is basically a caper detective story. The Fractal Prince matches the 1001 Nights, the Arabian stories. And The Causal Angels is sort of a cross between space opera and game-playing adventures. One of these massively parallelmorphic role-playing games.
Massive multiplayer dungeon.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what they're called.
So they've got various names, but the basic idea is the same.
Yeah.
And the storyline actually flows through the three novels. There is a logic to all the events that happen. But we start with looking perhaps at some of the characters. Hadu Rajaniemi, the author, said in an interview, "For me, science and technology are at least some of the most important factors driving societal change at the moment. Having a literary mode that deals with that and allows us to kind of anticipate what effect it might have on the human level is quite important. So I'm doing my best to pursue that." And he's certainly done a wonderful job in this series. Hadu shows, rather than tells us, about his future solar system. There are a few expository lumps, lots of neologisms in the novels. Some readers have found this hard going, so they have to track down what various things are and what they mean. But the key thing about Quantum Thief is basically it's a pulp novel. It's action all the way. So you don't need to think too much. There's something happening. And the characters are quite intriguing. Hadu makes good use of technical names and literary allusions, particularly in The Fractal Prince. Now, the action in The Quantum Thief starts in a prison. It's called the Dilemma Prison. And just to quote from the opening of the book, I'm going to try hard not to give away any major spoilers here. I just want to give you a bit of the taste for the language and style. Chapter 1, The Thief and the Prisoner's Dilemma. As always, before the Warmind and I shoot each other, I try to make small talk. Prisons are always the same, don't you think? I don't know if it can hear me. It has no visible auditory organs, just eyes, human eyes, hundreds of them, and the ends of stalks that radiate from its body like some exotic fruit. It hovers on the other side of the glowing line that separates our cells. The huge silver cult would look ridiculous in the grip of its twig-like manipulated limbs if it hadn't already shot me with it 14,000 times. Prisons like airports used to be on Earth. No one wants to be here. No one really lives here. We're just passing through. Today, the prison's walls are glass. There is a sun far above, almost like the real one, but not quite right, paler. Millions of glass-walled, glass-floored cells stretch to infinity around me. The light filters through the transparent surfaces and makes rainbow colours on the floor. Apart from them, my cell is bare, and so am I, birth naked, except for the gun. Sometimes when you win, you change the little things. The Warmind has been successful. It has zero-G flowers floating in its cell, red and purple and green bulbs growing out of bubbles of water, like cartoon versions of itself. Narcissistic bastard. If we had toilets, the doors would open inwards. Nothing ever changes. All right, so I am starting to run out of material. The Warmind raises its weapon slowly. A ripple passes through its eye stalks. I wish it had a face. The stare of its moist forest of orbs is unnerving. Never mind, it's going to work this time. I tilt the gun upward slightly, my body language and wrist movement suggesting the motion I would make if I was going to put up my gun. My every muscle screamed, "Cooperation, come on, fall for it, honest, this time, we're going to be friends." The fiery wink, the black pupil of his gun flashing. My trigger finger jerks. There are two thunderclaps and a bullet in my head. You never get used to the feeling of hot metal entering your skull and exiting through the back of your head. It's simulated in glorious detail. A burning train through your forehead, a warm spray of blood and brain on your shoulders and back, the sudden chill, and finally the black when things stop. The archons of the dilemma prison want you to feel it. It's educational. The prison is all about education and game theory, the mathematics of rational decision making. When you're in a mortal mind like the archons, you have time to be obsessed with such things, and it's just like the Sovenos, the upper lobe collective that rules the inner solar system, to put them in charge of their prisons. We play the same game over and over again in different forms, an archetypical game loved by economists and mathematicians. Sometimes it's chicken. We have races on endless highway, driving each other at high speeds, deciding whether or not to turn away at the last moment. Sometimes we're soldiers trapped in trench warfare, facing each other across no man's land. And sometimes they go back to basics and make us prisoners, old-fashioned prisoners, questioned by hard-eyed men. You have to choose between betrayal and the code of silence. Guns are the flavour of today. I'm not looking forward to tomorrow. I snap back to life like a rubber band, blinking. There is a discontinuity in my mind, a rough edge. The archons change your neural makeup a little bit every time you come back. They claim that eventually Darwin's whetstone will hone any prisoner into a rehabilitated cooperator. If they shoot and I don't, I'm screwed. If we both shoot, it hurts a little. If we cooperate, it's Christmas for both of us. Except that there is always an incentive to pull the trigger. The theory is that as we meet again and again, cooperative behaviour will emerge. A few million more rounds, and I'll be a Boy Scout. Right. My score after the last game is an ache in my bones. The war mind and I are both defected. Two games to go in this round. Not enough. Damn it. So that's the prison our hero, Jean Le Flambeur, is stuck in at the start of The Quantum Thief. He's the protagonist of the trilogy. Events are narrated from his point of view as Jean Le Flambeur, and they're all in the first person. Other points of view in the novels are narrated in the third person, including those in which Jean assumes another name, identity, or disguise. At the start of The Quantum Thief, he's imprisoned in the Dilemma Prison, a Sovenos prison located in the Neptunian Trojan Belt, but is eventually rescued by Mealy at the behest of Josephine Pellegrini and tasked to undertake another heist. Jean Le Flambeur is a famous thief, a trickster, a con man, an artist. As the Flambeur indicates, he's a gambler, big-time gambler. He risks all for big prizes. At the moment, he's in this prison, and he's not sure he is himself. As he notes in the beginning of the novel, there are multiple versions of him there, each slightly different. Every time he comes back from one of these tests, they've changed him somehow. So part of the whole first novel is him trying to regain his identity, regain his memories. And one of the ways he does that is to travel with Mealy to the Oublette, which is a walking city of Mars. The city rides on the back, on the mechanical backs of elephants as it strolls across the landscape, terraforming Mars. Now,
Elephants?
Elephants, yeah.
Are they feet or...
Mechanical. Mechanical elephants.
Okay.
So he gets to the city where he's trying to recover some memories that he's stored externally. The Oublette's a very interesting place because it's possibly one of the few places that's still effectively... human normal. The residents are human normal. They have been amended in various ways, and in particular they have the ability to customise their privacy screens. They have basically a mechanical screen around them. They wear a suit that generates Gevulot, which is Hebrew for borders. It's a privacy protocol used inside the Oubliette. It allows people there, both citizens and visitors alike, to set the desired level of privacy in every social situation. Now, it also lets them share memories and to access an external group memory, the exo-memory. People can obscure themselves from being seen by others if they're hidden behind a Gevulot fog. But that effect's only apparent. Analog recording devices like cameras can still see that they're there. But it's so ubiquitous that everyone seems to use it and doesn't notice what's going on. And this walking city on Mars, as I say, is one of the last human normal areas left. As we arrive there, we discover a detective, Isidore Boutrelet, the namesake of the boy detective in Maurice Leblanc's Arsène Lupin novel, The Hollow Needle. He's a student of architecture and amateur detective. He's only 10 Martian years old, which is about 18 Earth years, when he attracts unwelcome fame after solving a Gogol piracy case that was brought his attention by the gentleman. A Gogol is basically a disembodied mind. So Gogol piracy is someone stealing effectively your soccer. A name presumably after Nicholas Gogol, and Gogol pirates extract Gogols from people without prior consent. They have many ways to steal a Gogol, the simplest being an optogenetic method, but the Gevelo in the Oubliette provides a barrier to crude methods like that. And the Gogol pirates seem to be the servants of the Sobornost, which is collective post-human upload mind. So there's a worry about them breaking into the particular theft from the Oubliette. Now, Isidore matches wits with Jean Le Flambeur. Jean tries to penetrate Oubliette's privacy shields to recover memories, to restore himself and eventually locate the prize for which he was broken out of prison to grab. Now, there are a whole series of questions of identity that are brought up in this first novel. The fact that you can clone mind states, you can download people. Jean is one of many in the prison. He's not unique. He's possibly incomplete or altered, and he's missing some of his memories. He goes to the Oubliette to recover his stashed memories because he left. He used to live there once upon a time, and he left a stash of memories there that he wants. We have nanotech. We have possibly telepathy through some form of quantum entanglement. We've got mind transfers, artificial intelligence, and virtual realities. There are all sorts of technologies that crop up in this novel. And memories can be hidden selectively. It's like the circles of friends in Google Plus, if you like. They can be altered, they can be wiped, they can be changed. And the conflict between our detective and Jean de Florette occurs because one of the rich inhabitants suddenly realises he's lost a letter that he was holding a moment ago. Mm-hmm. Someone has erased his memory of what happened and who grabbed the letter and what the contents of the letter were. So there's a problem there. There's effectively a volunteer police force, the Tzadikim. Probably refers to a Jewish term, righteous. It may be a reference to the Tzaddik of the Seven Wonders, 1971 comic fantasy novel. And the other interesting thing you find in the Oubliette are the Resurrection Men and the Quiets. Basic idea, everyone has a certain amount of time they have left, and they can trade time with other people for services and effects and the like. But once the time runs out, they enter the quiet. Their brains are moved across to function, to run standard administrative tasks to keep the machine running, the society running, including running the elephants that transport the city. And once they've done their work, their time in the quiet, they're resurrected. So you've got quiets to defend the Oubliette from constant attacks of the Phoboi plague, which are basically nanobots that want to reassemble. You have security and civil service quiets, sometimes in humanoid form, sometimes others, and quiets who assist the Resurrection Men, who implement the resurrection laws in the Oubliette and bring people back. from the quiet to real life. Now, the exo-memory, it turns out, may also be subject to alteration or wiping. So there's something strange going on. One of the characters that I haven't mentioned, Mealy is actually an Urtian warrior of considerable power. Has atomic cannons in her hips, and other things. But just as you find in the culture novels, you have sentient spaceships. And Pehonen, which is butterfly in Finnish, is a sentient Urtian spider ship. She's flirtatious and often fills the inside of her ship with butterfly avatars. She was sung from the Alinen by Mealy. So the Urtians have figured out how to reconfigure nanites using songs. And in fact, as we hear in the second novel, there was a sequence where Mealy and her lover created huge ice sculptures in the Oort cloud by singing them. Yeah. And in the second novel, the fractal prince, we also see that stories have power as well. I should digress here and note that Jean Le Flambeur, the hero of these novels, is a thief. It's probably a reference to the French film Bob Le Flambeur.
Mm-hmm.
And there are loads of references to Arsène Lupin, a fictional gentleman thief and master of disguise created by the French writer Maurice Leblanc. Lupin's featured in 20 novels, 28 short stories, and the shorts were collected into book forms for a series of 24 books. And several of the characters in these novels reference names or Lupin novels. As I mentioned earlier, the boy detective Isidore is the namesake of the boy detective in the Arsène Lupin novel The Hollow Needle. Josephine Pellegrini, who's actually the Sobornos founder, employer of Mealy, and behind the whole release of Jean from prison, is named after the Countess of Cogliostro in the Arsène Lupin stories. And there are a few others that to echo names or themes in there. In the Fractal Prince stories, we'll see similar names echoing characters from the Arabian Nights. The other key character in the first novel is Mealy, which is Finnish for mind. She was sent by Josephine Pellegrini to break Jean out of prison, and Jean is then tasked to retrieve a parcel for her from the Oubliette. She is an Urtian warrior from the Urt cloud. So battle-ready, she has a fusion reactor embedded in her thigh. She's actually bonded to serve the Sobornos founder, Josephine Pellegrini. She lost her lover in Venus through integration and singularity and believes that Pellegrini will restore her lover back to her if she serves Pellegrini appropriately.
That's a job.
That's a job. Now, the Urtians are a humanoid race from the Urt cloud. Their culture is based on Finnish culture because the Urtian colonies were presumably seeded by Finnish refugees from Earth. Mealy's name is Finnish. Meaning
good little clues tell you. Yeah.
As is that of her lost lover, Sidan, which means harp. Jean makes reference to the Urtian deities Kutar and Ilmata. Both of them appear in the Kalevala, one being the moon spirit, the other the air spirit. Urtians appear to have functional wings, and they relax in saunas which are zero-g spheres of water, a thin force field protecting them from space or the dark man. And we see several examples of Mealy as being a very accomplished warrior and strategist in the course of the stories. The Fractal Prince deals with the telling of tales. It takes place on Earth, on the last effectively undamaged city on Earth called Seir. Earth's being ravaged by nanites called Wild Code, which seems to be a mix between nanomachines and biological agents of some sort. The remnants of humanity live in Sur and are protected from Wild Code and the Soberist, want to upload them all, by seals and words of power that were given to Tabitha Gomales' grandfather as part of a deal negotiated between the city and the jinns who inhabit the desert around Seir. Give you a feeling for the Arabian Nights telling of tales, words of power from the Fractal Prince. I'll just read a couple of excerpts. Chapter 2, Tawadud and Dunyazad. Before Tawadud makes love to Mr. Sen, the jinn, she feeds him grapes. She takes one from the bowl in her lap, peels it carefully, and holds it between her lips, kissing the sweet, moist flesh. When she bites, there's a faint metallic sigh from the jinn jar that's attached to the fine sensor net of the beamy in her hair by a thin white cable. Tawadud smiles and slowly eats another grape. She lets other sensations mingle with the taste this time. The feel of the silk of her robe on her skin, the luxurious weight of the mascara in her eyelashes, the jasmine scent of her perfume. Her former master, Kafur, taught her that embodiment is a fragile thing, made from the whispers and silences of the flesh. She gets up, walks to the keyhole-shaped window with slow, careful steps. The thin, delicate dance of the embodiment slave, moving so the gin bottle always stays out of sight, took 2 hours to place the embroidered pillows and mirrors and low tables in the narrow room just right. She allows the sun to warm her face for a moment and draws the soft curtains, and the light in the room takes on the hue of dark honey. Then she returns to her pillow seat at the round, low table in the centre of the room and opens the small jewelled casket that sits on top of it. Inside there is a book, hand-bound in cloth and leather. She takes it out slowly to let Mr. Sen enjoy the forbidden thrill that comes with it. The story within it is a true story, of course, the only kind you're allowed to tell in Sur. She knows it by heart, but looks at the words anyway as she reads aloud, running her fingers along the rough texture of the paper before turning a page. There was a young woman in Sur, she begins, not long after the coming of Sobornost and the cry of wrath, was married to a treasure hunter. The story of the Mutalibin's wife. Her father married her off when she was still very young. Her husband, the Mutalibin, was old beyond his years. His first wife was possessed and went to the city of the dead to live as a ghoul. After that, he went on long journeys to dig up old havens in the desert to mine gogles for the Sovereign Lost. He wore the scars of his work, troubled wild-coat dreams and sapphire growths that felt rough and sharp against her skin when they lay together. That was seldom. As Mutalibundu, he had long since given up desire to survive in the desert and touched her only because it was his duty as a husband. And so her days were lonely in their fine house up on the Uzedu Shard. One day she decided to build a garden on the roof of their house. She hired fast ones to fly up the loam from the greenhouses by the sea, planted seeds, told green ginny to make her seeds for flowers of all colours and trees to provide shade. She worked hard for days and weeks and asked her sister, Mutsib, to protect the garden from wild code with seals. At night, she whispered to her garden to make it grow. She'd studied Athar magic with jinn tutors in her father's house and knew many secret names. The jinn-made seeds grew quickly, and when the little garden was in full bloom, she spent long evenings sitting there, enjoying the smell of the earth and the fragrance of the flowers and the sun on her skin. One evening, a strong wind came from the desert. It blew over the shard and through the garden. It brought a cloud of old nanites with it that settled in the garden like thick, heavy fog. The little machines condensed into glittering droplets on the leaves and petals of her flowers. They were as fresh and pure as some of the ancient utility foglets and the stir in the sky that her father kept in a bottle in his study. The Mutalibin's wife started whispering and thinking at the fog, like she'd been taught. She lay down on the soft grass and asked the fog to make the hands and lips of a lover. The fog obeyed. It swirled around her and ran soft, cool fingers down her spine. It tickled her neck and collarbone with a tongue of mist. And it goes on, and it turns out in Sur, what's happened is the jinn have done this deal to protect them from the wild code and the Soberest, who want to steal their personalities and add them to the hive collective mind, by providing words of power, in return for which they're told stories which allow them to inhabit and experience actual flesh. And this is precisely what Tawadud Gomales was doing in that little segment I read out. Now, we should know that Tewadud is, of course, the namesake of the knowledgeable Tewadud in the story Abu al-Husn and his slave girl Tewadud. In the 1001 Nights, the slave girl is incredibly intelligent and accomplished in a whole range of fields of science and philosophy and history, playing chess and the like. And over the course of several nights, the deal she does, because she's the last slave of a poor man, she says to her owner, "Look, sell me to the rich man and you'll be wealthy and I'll make you proud of me." And so he takes her to the rich man and says, "You know, she has all these skills and accomplishments." And the rich man says, "Let me test her." And he then puts her to the test and brings in various experts to question her and test her. So as in the 1001 Nights, Tewadud is very practiced, intelligent and capable in the Fractal Prince. Her sister is Dunyazed. Now, this is actually the namesake of the sister of Scheherazade. So both of these names are references to 1001 Nights. There's a rivalry between Dunyazad and Tewadud. Dunyazad is a respectable Mutasib, trusted by her father, while Tewadud is the black sheep of the family. And then it turns out that there is a murder committed, and they need to deal with what happens. And what happens is that a Samanguru, a Sovanos founder and a war mind, is sent to the city of Sur to try and track down the murderer and find out exactly what's happening. We find out in the course of the novel that Tewadud makes good use of the seals of power and her stories. Amongst other things, she activates a magic carpet, which is then used to beat off an attack by spaceships upon the city. And it's a delightful read, because as you go through and she meets djinns and various other characters, she tells them a tale, and within that tale, they tell another tale to the person who's then telling another tale. So it's this tale within tale within tale. And the tale I read a moment ago, you may have noticed, actually mirrors Tewadud's actual situation as the whore of monsters that she's known. The city's earth has been ravaged by nanites and the wild coat. The remnants still live in Cern, protected by the seals and the words of power that Tewadud's grandfather negotiated with the djinn. So that's basically the story that happens in the middle book. And one of the things that happens in there is Jean de Le Flambeau actually goes there and meets with the axolotl, his one of the lovers of Tewadud, Gomelez, reputed to be the father of the body thieves, and that aids Jean in his quest to recover something that Josephine Pellegrini requires. The third book, The Causal Angel, takes place immediately after the events in The Fractal Prince, which reach a fairly climactic section. It's actually set in the world of Zoku, the gameplay world, and that's where Mili's taken at the end of Fractal Prince. She's separated from Jean. Now, the Zoku clans are game players. You get credit for playing the game or leveling up, and that also entrails you with the group will, so it becomes harder to do something that the Zoku doesn't want. And there are a few gags in there, things like the Gringotts Zoku look after the finances and things like that. Now, Jean, who at the end of The Fractal Prince is now free, is clearly being changed by his experiences, because he's now promised to rescue Mili, which is not something the old Jean would have done. See what happens in terms of the game. Let's just read. The Zoku love playing games, and at one point, as part of his trying to infiltrate the Zoku and find out what happened to Mili, Jean deals with the gun club. The thief and the gun club. Just before the Yapitus job starts to go south, Barbicane, the gun club elder, and I watch Zoku Chilton play global thermonuclear war. We drink dark tea in the mahogany panelled drawing room of the gun club Zoku's copper and brass skytrain. It rides smoothly along the bright golden curve of the club's orbital ring round Yapitus, fast enough to create a cosy half a G of artificial gravity. Our view of the Saturnian moon's surface through the large circular viewports is spectacular. We're above the Cassini Regio, a reddish-brown birthmark that stains the white of the icy surface. It makes Yapitus look like a giant yin-yang symbol. And inside the Turgis crater, 500 kilometres in diameter, directly below us, is a miniature Earth. A disk of green and blue, its continents and seas circumscribed by a glowing silver line. The Cold War Reenactment Society, they call it, Barbicane says in his bassoon voice. He gestures at the view flamboyantly with the gleaming fractal foliage of his manipulator arm. It makes a tinkling sound against the viewport glass. The amber halo of Zoku jewels orbiting a stovepipe hat, like a miniature solar system, makes Barbicane look like a melancholy saint. In contrast to most members of his Zoku, the Elder's primary body actually has biological components left. His head belongs to a 50-something man with impressive red sideburns, a prominent nose, and a fierce blue-eyed gaze. But the rest of him is artificial, a rounded, cast-iron torso, a Boschfort manipulator arm, and a heavier cylindrical gun limb. His legs are brass stumps, exhaust ports for small iron engines. He smells faintly of machine grease, metal polish, and an old man's aftershave. Too modern for me, dear Raoul, far too modern. But I applaud their enthusiasm. They even made the warheads by hand, the old-fashioned way. Synchrotrons and plutonium. Ah, Barbicane makes a rumbling sound of pleasure. In fact, they had a little help this time. I smile, recalling my dealings with the Zoku youth a few days ago, in a different guise from my current persona of Raoul Dandersy, an emigre and antique dealer from Ceres. Give children matches and they'll start fires. Nothing ever changes. The silver ring running along the crater's steep edge is a Zoku magic circle that defines the boundary of the playground and the rules of reality within. The North American continent inside is dark, perforated by pinpoints of city lights. Every now and then, it's lit for a second by the dazzling wink of a hydrogen bomb. Delightful, I say, as the East Coast goes up in a shower of nuclear sparks. The response is already on its way. White parabolic arcs of ballistic missiles reach from Moscow and Leningrad like skeletal, clawed fingers. Suddenly, I wonder what they saw in the oubliette when the rain of fire started. Maybe it was the Sovinost, as the system chatter would have us believe. Maybe it was Josephine covering her tracks. Maybe the Chens did not want an active Zoku presence so closely in the system without Earth as a buffer zone. Maybe the Vasilevs and the Senkus just wanted to stop anyone else from getting the oubliette mines they'd been pirating for years. I want to believe one of these things is true. At least that way there'd be a chance of the oubliette citizen survivors' goggles somewhere. But deep down, I know the truth is worse. You see, they're very fond of playing games and creating virtual realities and similar things. And we discover that Mealy has been captured by one of these Zokus. Mealy and the Mountain. The Gaki attack when you make it up to the mountain's shoulder ridge in the early morning. They're above the clouds now, and the last rays of the sun turn the cloud tops into a mixture of pink and blue. A chilly wind comes down the white slope of the mountain, bringing tiny snowflakes. The breath of Yuki Ona, the White Witch. She knows you're coming. There are pits in the mountainside above. The Gaki emerge from them slowly, like pale tongues from dark mouths. They're emaciated, withered creatures, except for their swollen bellies filled with dark blood. They sniff the air and come down the mountain path, hesitantly at first, then at a loping run. Her katana comes out of its scabbard of its own volition, a sliver of bright silver. The first Gaki hisses and swings the scythe-like arm at you. Its smell makes you gag, excrement, wet earth and decay. Her katana draws a lightning arc in the air. Ash-coloured liquid spurts out from the stump of the Gaki's outstretched paw. It backs off, clacking its teeth together angrily, yellow eyes burning. Then you see two of its comrades going up the slope to the right. They scamper back down towards your flank. There's an outcropping not that far below with a large standing boulder that would protect your back. But getting there requires risking the steep, snowy slope. A Gaki makes the decision for you. It hurls itself straight at you, looking to impale itself on your blade. You dance slightly to one side, slice at its legs, it rolls down the slope, and you follow it, making crazy leaps as rocks rattle and roll between your feet, praying that your ankle won't catch and twist. You nearly fall close to the bottom, but catch yourself in a half-roll, come back up and turn around, breathing hard. Your back's now protected, but a half-circle of Gaki is coming at you, clawing and hissing and clacking and spitting. You wait. The wind picks up. Feels like a good place to die. Your only regret is that the Yuki Ona will escape your vengeance and keep your lover's soul. You grip the katana lightly, like a calligrapher's brush. Prepare to write a haiku of death. A feathered arrow sprouts from the neck of the gaki in the middle. More come arcing down at the others in rapid succession. You advance with rapid shuffling steps and strike left and right. A gaki head rolls down the mountainside. Then another ronin appears behind the gaki. He, or she, judging by her light frame, wields a naginata and wears an usagi mask, the cross-marked white face of a demon rabbit. She spins her weapon in an arc and clears the space around her, then lunges forward to pierce the gaki's chest. She stops to look at you, her eyes flash behind the mask. Your battle goes quickly after that. You coordinate your movements, swift sword and reaching naginata. It feels like you're back in the dojo, and even on the uneven ground of the mountain, difficult strokes become easy, and the gaki falls before you like wheat. Soon they flee, leaving dismembered bodies behind. The rocks are slick with their gore. Afterwards, you're the first to bow. Honored Ronin, you say, you have saved my life. She bows back and removes her mask. Her face is dark skin, and her long jet black hair is tangled with sweat. The honor is mine, she says, with a soft voice that's like a whisper of silk wiping blood off a blade.